Hey, you.
It'll be this good. Exciting.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Sega Guys Retropod. My name is James, better known in Twitterland as the Dreamcast Addict, and I'm delighted to be joined by my partner in crime for this project, Dan, who you will know as Swooper D on Twitter. So, how you doing, Dan?
Hi, James. It's great to finally get this started, mate.
Welcome, Sega fans, to the podcast that has somehow lived longer than the 32X, the Nomad, the Dreamcast, and even the Sega Saturn, at least in the West. It's the Sega guys, still here after half a decade of Sega-fueled mayhem, with me, Dan the Mega Driver, and the Dreamcast to my Sega Saturn is James the Sega-holic. Hey, mate, how you doing?
I'm very good, mate. I can't believe it's been 5 years of doing this. We knew it was coming up. But just obviously we're sitting down to get ready to record, and I'm looking there on the Apple Podcast feed on 18th of April 2020, mate. The lockdown pod, as we called ourselves, you know. Mate, just crazy to think again that a couple of DMs and a tweet led to 5 years of this, you know what I mean? It's crazy, but aye, here we go. Well, older, greyer. Well, you've not changed much. I'm certainly fatter.
I'm definitely fatter.
So, we're still here, mate. Still going. Still a pair of grumpy old Sega bastards. But aye, I thought it'd be nice to kind of go back and look at that first episode and maybe try and redo it a wee bit, or kind of go over the games that were discussed in that episode and just kind of reflect on 5 years of this amazing project that we've been on together.
I know, mate. 5 years, over 100 episodes. We passed the 100 episode mark a while ago, didn't we? I remember you messaged
me. I didn't know it, though.
No, neither of us did. It's like, when we passed in 100 episodes? Oh, we're already at 103. All right. It's going to be a bit late for that one.
Thanks, yeah. By the way.
We are older, but it's like Optimus Prime when he has the Matrix in his hand at the end of Return of Optimus Prime Part 2. We're all a little bit wiser now. I think going through the blog was an eye-opener when I spotted that I'd written that the Sega Saturn had a second VDP chip inserted into it, which was... But in my defense, I don't think that the Sato interview had been translated by that point.
No. Right. Well, I mean, again, how many years ago it was? It was way back. Like, you're talking, that was like year one, and there was no Sato interviews, and we were still going off the information that was very much being misspread around the internet, you know, which is why we do this, the bastions of truth in the Sega community.
Yeah. We started 5 years ago, obviously. Few DMs onto it. It was replying to Super Nerds, wasn't it? He was like, well, when was Sega the most creative? I said Sega Saturn, you said Sega Dreamcast. You were the Dreamcast Addict at the time.
Shite name that was, by the way. I clamoured around for a handle online, it was bad. Like, I think I went by the Xbox Scott at one point as well, because I was like going between like kind of like modern gaming and retro gaming, and then I did the Dreamcast Addict, and then I tried the original Dreamcast guy because I thought Dreamcast guy was a dick. So I basically went, well, I'm more of an original Dreamcast guy than he is, so I'll just be the OG Dreamcast guy. And it's like, oh, man. And then eventually settled on the name that people know me by now. The whole Dreamcast Addict thing, I mean, to put context on the whole Dreamcast thing, like, obviously, at the time that I kind of get into the retro community, I kind of went and picked up a Dreamcast, and I got it for CEX. It was discounted. It was £40. So discounted, not as in discounted in price, but, you know, you've got boxed, unboxed, discounted, right? Only CEX could be kind of daft enough that they would mark a mint condition Dreamcast is discounted because it didn't come with an RF cable. So because it came with a composite cable and a SCART block adapter, because it wasn't the original cables, they marked it as discounted, even though it's a better cable solution than the RF. So that's CEX for you, everybody.
That's a nice little tip for anyone that hasn't got their hands on a Dreamcast yet. Get a discounted one from CEX. That's not a bad deal. It's all you want to do is go and get yourself another cable anyway, whether it's a pound cable, Geico, whether you're going to get a VGA cable, put it through an OSSC.
That's that, mate. You know, it's if it's in good enough nick, I think they're about 75, 80 quid, and they've doubled in price for a discounted one now, but... I mean, again, you can back a long time, but I mean, I tried to get a Dreamcast kind of a couple of years before that. It flags up in my Facebook memory sometimes as well. And I think I'll send you, you can flag it up on screen. And it's delighted to get my hands on this little console again, right? I got it off eBay and it just wouldn't read discs. Like, get to the third stage of Power Stone, it would just crash no matter what character you picked. Games were just like Crazy Taxi, the music would stop and you'd get that wee message at the bottom, this disc is dirty, please clean it, blah blah blah. So I returned it. Guy was really good. I remember buying the guy I bought it for, he was really good to deal with. I sent it back. But I went back to like the last Sega that I had. And like obviously the Saturn was still in there as kind of memories, but it wasn't until obviously my uncle found the original Saturn up in his loft, and I got that. And that changed everything. That was, you know, when was that? That happened 2021? Was that April 2021 that happened? So, that changed everything, mate. That was never the old feelings came back, and the memories all kind of got unlocked again. But the Dreamcast Addict, what a shit username, mate, honestly.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it, mate.
I'm rebranded. You know what I mean? That's been through a refresh.
Yeah, I mean, I'd had my consoles back for a while. So there was a while that I was without them when I first moved up to where I live now. But you know, when I had kids and stuff, I didn't have all my retro consoles. There, it's just in my Sega Saturn success video. It's there. It's there, ever presence in my setup all the way until I move out. It wasn't for a few years that I brought it back into my own. Connor, my eldest, I got the Saturn out to give to him. I was playing Panzer Dragoon with him, and I got the Dreamcast out to the younger two, because I burned discs of like Disney Magical Racing and stuff like that. I was trying to get them into it because they wanted a console to play on, and they were the ones that I had. Yeah, and then got the Mega Drive out, and it was just slowly just getting all this stuff back from my mum's until I managed to get it all back. And it became less and less about something to share with the kids, and they weren't interested. They just wanted to play Minecraft on their 360s in the end, and it all just became all about me.
What's that, mate? And then, obviously, as you said, we replied to Super Nerd's tweet. Simon, his name was it?
Simon, yeah.
Yeah, reply to his tweet, and we had a wee kind of to and fro in the replies, and then kind of in the DM, and I think we originally talked about doing like a kind of like a blog entry, which we did. Or did we do the blog entry?
We did the blog. That's where I found the piece of text that said that it was a second right. VDP, because we did the podcast and we did the blog, and the blog was kind of died a death in the end. I think it was. Well, it was very spotty anyway when we first started it, and then once when we went on the hiatus, it just died a death.
Right.
And when we came back from the hiatus, it was less the blog and more doing the YouTube content.
The channel, aye. By the long-standing joke, mate, in the WhatsApp chat, if you search for this, there'll be about 400 entries of it. The immortal words that I remember I says, try to start a podcast, mate.
I know.
Well, mental.
No, here we are, it's 5 years later, season six opener. Obviously, the actual fifth anniversary was a few days ago recording this. This isn't going out that soon after this because we've got Sega Lord X doing a guest appearance on our podcast for
third or fourth time, yeah.
Yeah. So who would have thought that we would be there when we started this 5 years ago, but...
Hi, mate. Sega Lord X, P Peter Moore, Tom Kalinske, Al Nelson, Blake J. Harris,
John Lineman.
John Lineman. You know what I mean? Crazy. Absolutely mental.
But all brought together because of Sega, mate.
That's it. The love of Sega has brought it all together. That's it. It's that passion and that nostalgia. It's just a kind of perfect blend. You know, I think it's we've both been very similar ages and kind of similar experiences as well, whether it's retail bias against Sega or the games that we kind of resonate towards. We're very like-minded, and I think that's why it works as well as it does.
It's nice as well that it's kind of coincided with this almost the resurrection of Sega to a degree, or Sega, you know, themselves rising to prominence. They were publisher of the year last year, as you know, per Metacritic and anyone else that hands out these awards. You know, they had a absolutely banging year last year. They had a pretty good year when we first started the podcast. And then they've got the whole new wave of Sega classics coming in. We've got Shinobi coming this year, Streets of Rage, Crazy Taxi, Jet Set Radio, Golden Axe in the pipeline, apparently more to come.
Movie with Michael Bay.
Run with Michael. What is that all about? You know, someone created a screenshot of it's just Outrun with the Ferrari, and it's going off to the distance, and instead of like the, you know, the blue skies, it's got just a huge explosion off in the background.
I says, mate, it needs to finish with Optimus Prime doing a narration and then like Linkin Park, you know.
My name is Optimus Prime, and I send this message to any Ferraris on special route C. We are here. We are waiting.
That's it. You know, it needs to happen, mate. Directed by Michael Bay, black screen, silver text. Box it up and send it to the studio, mate. That's it.
If it leads to a new Outrun game, I'm all in.
Well, that's it. That's it, mate. But you're right. It's like the kind of the rise that we've had as a channel and a podcast, the way it's not just coincided with kind of Sega's own kind of like resurrection or renaissance, but also I think the rise in kind of retro gaming as well. Like, we couldn't have handpicked a better time to start it. We didn't know it at the time, but if you look back 5 years ago and you think about what we had in terms of mods, in terms of ODEs, in terms of homebrew, like the scene that we have just now is absolutely on fire compared to what it was when we started. Like whenever we started, it was very much, yeah, prices were high for kind of more rare games, but it was still pretty affordable. You know, it wasn't obscene the way it is now. So people were still resonating towards maybe, it was more still about collecting and playing, and then you kind of seen this kind of this shift. Whereas the kind of prices started to rise, you know, collecting really came to the prominence and came to the fore. And then you started getting the ODEs and the mods, and then like all of a sudden you were seeing people coming in who maybe like had owned a system all those years ago and were now coming back to it. And I'm not just talking about Saturn or Dreamcast, I'm talking about Master System, Mega Drive. You just look around at, you know, look at the advancements in like the EverDrive Pros, all these, everything just seems to be snowballing. And it just seems like year on year, we're just seeing more and more advancements. And we just seem to come in at the start of it all. And that's what's exciting. It seems to like we're kind of growing along with like the community, like these communities, whether it's Dreamcast, Saturn, the Brazilian Mega Drive scene, whatever, you know, the homebrew stuff that we're seeing with the Dreamcast, like J.N. Martin's stuff, you know, Doom 64, Wipeout, the Grand Theft Auto guys, the Skimp and Falco. Like, he's mad. If you told us 5 years ago you'd be playing GTA 3 in your Dreamcast, we'd have laughed at us. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's mental.
It has. It's been incredible to actually watch it all kind of unfold. Mm-hmm. I think it's moved into a next phase, I think, because before the podcast started, I think the sort of the NES and SNES and kind of, I suppose, the Mega Drive era was kind of petering out, because, you know, I think if you put a Streets of Rage 2 retrospective on, as much as I'd love to do one, I think it's like that's been done to death now. And that's why I think a lot of the Sega Saturn and the Dreamcast stuff is really catching on, because it's stuff that people, either they get into the age, you know, Dreamcast is
obviously a lot longer, younger than the other Sega consoles. People are of that demographic. Maybe you get people that aren't, you know, we're over our 40, over 40. You've got people that are in their 30s, just hitting 30, that grew up with the Dreamcast as their first console. They had it when they were actually like children. So it's, you know, that sort of generation's coming of age. That's why it's grown to prominence. And then the Sega Saturn, again, it was just one that people didn't know as much about. And now that's, people are discovering that. Before we started, before when we started the podcast, mate, I don't think Professor Abrasive had quite cracked, you know, the the kind of the anti-piracy thing behind it. And now as a result of that, we had the Satiator, we've got Fenrir, we've got all these ODEs, then we've got Saru, you know, becoming something else now. So it really has been kind of, you know, we could be lucky to be in this period where there was just so much going on in Sega, in the community, you know, the console communities, Sega themselves, you know, it's been an awful lot going on. So it's been brilliant. And what will we see in the next 5 years, mate? Well,
that's it, you know. I mean, I'm just looking at the age demographic of our audience on YouTube. We were talking about the kind of, so the predominant age group that we've got is 35 to 44, which is 48% of our viewers. But the 25 to 34 makes up 14%. So, you know, what you're saying there, that kind of 25 to 35, people who were just maybe, like, as you say, young kids, maybe it was the hand-me-down Big Brother's Dreamcast, you know, it could be something like that. I just don't know. But, you know, there's three, what I really love about this, mate, this is the future of the channel. 55 to 64, 3%. There we go. Come on, the oldies. Yes. Young at heart, that's what we like to hear. And
that'll
see.
Be us before you know it, mate.
don't, mate, don't. Because that's what I'm talking about. 5 years already. Do you say, next 5 years, where are we going to be? I'll tell you, right here.
Talking Sega. But yeah, it's a great shout to start revisiting this discussion, mate, because when we first, and we can put the old podcasts on YouTube if people wanted to watch them with some sort of video. They're also on your podcatchers and stuff, but they're a little bit ropey, you know. This is my, you obviously had a bit of experience. I had none. So I was very raw going in.
Well, that's the thing as well. Like, I don't know if people who even watch the channel are aware, like, that there is like a full 3.5 seasons of the Sega guys. It's just on audio only. It's on like Spotify and Amazon and Google Play and Apple Podcasts. It's on all of them. So there might be people watching this who watches on the channel every week that don't realize that there's like some really ropey amateurish. But I mean, I threw you in at the deep end, mate. I obviously did like an Italian football podcast for about 2.5 years. And I was a kind of host on that. Whenever obviously my first was born, it made it quite kind of difficult due to the fact that the people I did the podcast with were all based in the US. They were all based on the East Coast. So it often involved like recording at 10, 11 o'clock at night, sometimes midnight, sometimes 1 a.m. And that just wasn't feasible anymore, unfortunately. We are a wee babby around, you know what I mean? So that I kind of had to step away from that. But I had that experience there. But yeah, the initial episodes were me kind of hosting. But I kind of says, how do you fancy a shot at me? And also, you'd never done anything like it before. And I think the listening back, I think the dynamic works well. You kind of opening and then bringing me in, and we've got the such and such to my such and such, and it lets us kind of kick things off with a wee gag or two. So, no, the dynamic works perfectly, mate. So, aye, long may it continue.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course it will. And, yeah, for this one, then, we'll be talking about, you know, when was Sega their most... their most innovative was the question. When were they their most creative? And, you know, the way that we set it out, it was two episodes. You hosted the first one. And it was me doing the Sega Saturn games, wasn't it? So we had the idea was we'd do two episodes, five games each, and plead our case for what would be the Sega's most creative, most innovative time on a console. And I think one thing that I was thinking about, mate, before we kind of get into it, is It's quite interesting to think of it as Sega's most creative and innovative time on a console. But really, when you talk about Sega at their most creative and innovative, it's got to be really the arcades, isn't it?
Looking back and being honest, that's where everything came from. That was sat on the Dreamcast, obviously got the bulk of their games from being arcade ports, you know, from the AM divisions. So I mean, it was the arcade was a melting pot, and it just basically churned out all these amazing games that the teams tried their best, especially on Saturn, to fit them onto a CD, you know. So I mean, it was the arcade is where it was happening. Even though it was dying a death, Sega were still pumping out absolute behemoth titles on cutting-edge hardware. And we were just lucky enough that they were trying to fit these onto these two machines that sat under your TV.
I was having a little laugh to myself. I was recording some footage for another video that I'm hoping to get up soon, of a certain 8-bit system. Won't go into any more of that, but I was thinking, you know, this at the time, Space Harrier was just like cutting bleeding edge in technology, the superscalar graphics, and that's been Sega the whole time. And I was thinking, did the CS teams, did the home port teams, like look at the guys in the arcade, Yu Suzuki's creating this elaborate new cutting edge arcade game on this really expensive hardware, and it's like, all right, now you lot make it work on this £200 box. They're trying to put it like, you bastards.
It's all right, you just stick some screenshots in the back and put tiny little text saying, from the arcade version.
Yeah, if you're talking about the computer ports, then yeah. But yeah, Sega actually, what I'm finding out is that Sega never actually did any of the computer ports at all. It was all licensed out to like Elite and Ocean, US Gold. There's a few others.
US Gold, man. Elite did Space Harrier on the Atari ST.
Yeah, they did the Commodore 64 port as well, and it's pretty decent. They were good. The Rambo 2 on the Commodore 64. Oh, what a Jeez. Game that was. What a game that was.
Are there any Sega games on the Spectrum? Can't remember any.
Yeah, there'll be plenty. There'll be
loads.
Must be.
It must exist.
Yeah, you've definitely got Outrun on there. They're all kind of, you know, the Color Clash and everything like that, but they're on there.
I might tackle that one then for the video, since yeah. I grew up on a specky, you know.
Yeah. Responding, kind of, obviously, it's probably a big hint to what 8-bit system I'm covering anyway.
I know, you say that my name and I'm like, what's that about the wind into? It's like...
Yeah, so obviously Sega, most influential, most innovative, most creative in the arcade. But the question that Simon of Super Nerds asked back in 2020 was, you know, when was Sega the most innovative on console? And I came out, I said Sega Saturn, you said Sega Dreamcast, and pitched 5 games each. And it's probably just worth going through what those games were for each system. So, mate, I've taken these from the blog post that we did that accompanied it. Now, I think we both, from memory, I think we both wrote our separate parts, didn't we? So I think yours was first on the Dreamcast side. Mine was second, even though the pod's the other way around.
That's right, aye. Even then, we were scatterbrained, you know what I mean? That's
nothing changes, mate.
No. I'm trying to scroll through this blog post because there's a game on here that I don't know why I put it on the list. It's not a Sega game.
Let's go through, and you know, we got Shenmue, which obviously needs no introduction. I mean, the game just got voted most influential video game of all time at the BAFTAs, for crying out loud. So yeah, there's no arguments on that one. Jet Set Radio, in terms of popularizing cell shading, you know, in terms of what it did with its music, its controls, its whole premise, you know, that's creativity and innovation. Sonic Adventure, I mean, look, people like to shit on that game. But you think, where was I watching something the other day and someone was talking about it? I can't remember. Do you know what? I think it might actually have been Gaming for Ages that were talking about it, because I don't think it gets enough credit for how big those stages were. You know, you had tiny little like stages in Mario and Banjo, comparatively tiny. Banjo-Kazooies were a bit bigger, but Sonic's, you know, just to accommodate his speed, they were absolutely enormous. So like the size of the stages, the speed that he moved at, and obviously you've got the other five characters as well, which was pretty innovative. Red, again, no, you can't argue with that one either, can you? Just the creativity and the vision behind old Miz, you know, moved on from Sega Rally to and his Game Gear goggles to create that masterpiece.
Game Gear last goggles.
One, yeah, and the last one, which I think you're trying to scratch your head about, is Soul Calibur. But I think the point you were making on that one was just how Sega will change the way that they worked with third parties to deliver something that was better than Arcade Perfect in that instance. And to that extent, I think that point still stands on that one. It was an absolutely seismic release. I don't think we'd seen at that point a game that had come out just so quickly after the arcade version and was better than Arcade Perfect. So strong, strong five games in there, mate.
I just had a look at the blog post there, and you're right, that was the angle that I came from, that until the Xbox Live, or the Xbox, was it Xbox Live Arcade? Until that version came out, the only place you could play it was a Dreamcast. It did come out on iOS briefly, and then it was lost after the whole 64-bit iOS update, where if the developers didn't update the apps, they were lost once you updated your iOS. So I lost several games, Jet Set Radio HD as well. I lost that. Soul Calibur. But with Soul Calibur, it was the fact that Sega had provided this hardware, they got relationships with third parties, which was something they were criticised for with the Saturn. And, you know, you had a game that was above and beyond the original arcade version. Like, it's the first game of that scale to be beyond Arcade Perfect. I think there's somebody corrected me on a video before, whenever I mentioned, maybe my Dreamcast fighting games video or something, I can't remember what it was, but you did Dreamcast fighting games, what was the video I did, I mentioned Soul Calibur, I can't remember, but they kind of corrected me saying that it was the first game to go beyond Arcade Perfect, and there was some Mega Drive game mentioned. I was like, okay,
there'd been games beyond Arcade Perfect before, but they were generally old ports. They're ports of old games that had been essentially spruced up. Soul Calibur was barely a year old when it came to the Dreamcast. That's the thing. That's why it's so, because it was on Namco's System 22 board, maybe 23. So it was cutting edge. They were talking about doing a PlayStation port.
The ironic thing about that, mate, is that in the issue of Edge, issue 60. That Dreamcast is unveiled at the New Challenge Conference, the orange cover, Sega is dead, long live Dreamcast. At the very back, in the arcade feature section, Soul Calibur, and they are literally in that whole article talking about why Tekken 3 proves that Soul Calibur will come to the PlayStation.
Yeah, because it's the same board as Tekken 3.
Yep.
So obviously Tekken 3 wasn't Arcade Perfect. It's not like Tekken 1 and 2, which were done on PlayStation hardware, effectively, the System 11. Tekken 3 and Soul Calibur were done on the System 23 or 22. So they were kind of beyond the PlayStation. But yeah, everyone expected them to go be ported down. Tekken 3 obviously was, Soul Calibur was ported up. Right. And yeah, it was just we saw it in Arcade Club, didn't we? The original.
Yes, that's right. It was on, it was a kind of row of cabinets. It was beside Tekken 3. It was a row of cabinets as you were heading out towards the stairs.
Yeah.
And I think the screen had a little bit of ghosting on it, if I remember, as well. It wasn't, I think that one was kind of quite, not disrepair, but it needed a wee bit of kind of maintenance on it. But even looking at it, it was, you could see, Like Tekken 3 and PS1's a great port, don't get me wrong, it's phenomenal. But it's got a very stylized kind of Namco look to it. You know, you could see the similarities between Tekken 3 and Soul Calibur and the arcade. But when it came to Dreamcast, it was like, it was one of the games where you booted it up. I still remember I got my copy from a place called Partick Game Station for the Dreamcast. And it was like, I don't know why this guy like had this one copy of Soul Calibur for the Dream. He was only wanted 35 quid for it. And I traded in some big box Amiga games towards it, right? Rushed back up the road with Sam, got those big box Amiga games, traded them in towards it, and we just took Soul Calibur home. And I remember booting it up, and me and Sam just sitting there like we could not believe. I had a big 4x3 Toshiba CRT at the time. Had a big matching grey stand, so it looked like it was all in one kind of unit. Glass doors in it. You had to open up one side to get the glass door out, and two shelves and all that. Great TV. But loading that up on that, and it was so smooth. Like, the level of detail was, like, ridiculous. The textures on the ground. Okay, there's elements of the background that are 2D as well, you know, but there's the kind of 3D buildings there as well. Everything about it just looked like you couldn't believe what you were seeing. Like, it was like a seismic jump for anything. Like, I always remember whenever we unlocked Lizard Man, and like, we were going right up to the TV screen, like, you can see the scales. You can see the scales. It's like you could count them. It was a seismic release. Really did hit home, you know, just how powerful this little box was. As you say, mate, there had been Beyond Arcade's perfect ports before, but it was older games getting the treatment. This was a game that was, like you said, within a year, you know, that it was done. And kind of odd as well that such a big title that had been synonymous, obviously, and its kind of predecessors like Soul Blade or Soul Edge, whatever you come from, that was synonymous with PlayStation. And yet, Sega somehow got Namco on board, agreeing to bring it to Dreamcast. It's like, and not PlayStation. You know, obviously Soul Calibur 2 would come to everything, you know, apart from Dreamcast. The ultimate irony. There you go, you're left in the dark. But what a game. And again, that was a kind of the angle for the innovation part, or, you know, creativity angle, is that they provided that hardware to take a brand new game and make it better than the arcade version.
Yeah. And incredible feat because of all the reasons that you just said, mate. When looking at this list, one thing that jumps out at me is no Crazy Taxi, which you know, after 5 years, I would have thought that would have been a givey.
Just my favourite Dreamcast game, mate. Just left it off the list.
I mean, because that in itself was hugely innovative and influential, and even caused Sega to sue EA for stealing their
idea. For the waypoint of the arrow, yeah. I mean, this list is just like, I feel like I'm on trial here, man. The defense calls a Sega holic to the stand. It's like, I'm Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson are going to pop it here.
All I'm doing is commenting on the lack of Crazy Taxi. After 5 years of doing this, mate, that's not there.
You want Crazy Taxi? I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
You can't handle the crazy money.
Yeah, BD Joe. But I mean, a whole lot to pick five. I mean, the fact I put Soul Calibur in there, no Crazy Taxi. But if I was to redo the list now, then Crazy Taxi would be in there.
No. The thing is, I think we've been doing this. While we've been doing this, it's been kind of a journey of discovery for ourselves as well.
Absolutely, mate.
You know, there are a lot of the games that we've played, you know, while we've been doing the podcast and doing the channel, I think it's really opened some doors and getting involved with other communities. You know, mm-hmm. You know, everyone, Shiro have opened our eyes to a few things as well. You know, it's easy to look at this sort of stuff off, but there's nothing wrong with that list at all, I don't think. You know, as I say, you can see why, you know, you argued your point for Soul Calibur well. And the others are, you know, I don't think you can argue with them at all. It's only just from a personal perspective that I thought,
aye,
James hasn't put Crazy Taxi on it. If you ask James to list this one get a Dreamcast game, it'd be Crazy Taxi.
Crazy Taxi's the first one I'm putting in the list now, mate. That's it's like a journey through your own past as well. Because like it sounds daft, but there's a lot of kind of memories in gaming that as the years go on and you move on to new consoles and new life experiences and things like that, that you just things just get cast to the back of your mind. It's not until like you're playing these again. Like the thing is, I remember again getting Crazy Taxi, the import copy from Charlie's, but like I can only recount that now because like playing the game and kind of being in the community and things like that and being so entrenched in it is it's triggering all these kind of memories. That's the thing. It's like the stuff at the back of your mind. I mean, how many times have we been sitting here talking with Tom Chalmers on as well, and we've said something and we've sat there and went, oh, you've just unlocked a memory. It's like it happens, you know what I mean? So aye, mate. We'll do the list again in our time.
Yeah. well, my five. So the first, so I was obviously Team Saturn on this discussion. The first one is Panzer Dragoon, which I think I'd probably stand by that one. So in terms of influence and creativity.
Your list is like solid. Your list is like not changed. It's like your list has stood the test of 5 years.
Well, I don't know, because Guardian Heroes, that was treasure. You can't give it the same merit as you would say Soul Calibur, because it didn't. It wasn't bolstered by Sega effectively creating the hardware for it to do. I suppose. A bit looser for Guardian Heroes, though. Virtual One. Now, that's an interesting one. You know, I didn't read my reasoning behind that one. But I suppose it kind of ushered in the polygonal arena fighter to a degree. plays a lot like, I suppose, the Dragon Ball Sparking Zero, Takachi Budokai, whatever games. That may be a little bit of a stretch. And Nights into Dreams, obviously, you know, creativity in that one is massive. So I'd probably say Guardian Heroes and Virtual One are the weakest two there.
Well, your reasoning for Virtual On is, given the arcade action and scope of the gameplay, the Saturn should not have been able to produce a serviceable port, yet not only did it manage to house an outstanding conversion, it added a two-player split-screen option too.
That's a porting perspective.
Aye, that's fair enough, mate. I mean, even more so, again, with the things that you find out as time goes by, that they made it without the fucking SGL.
Yeah,
so it makes it an even better port than you thought it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, if I was going to swap, well, I'd probably swap Guardian Heroes for Sega Rally. And even and I think it's one of these things that you've grown to appreciate a bit more. I've always loved Sega Rally, you know, we both have. Well, I think it's getting to understand and getting that perspective of the impact it had on the industry as a whole, and how it was. It's another thing that you take it for granted at the time. This is a really good racing game. It's a brilliant racing game. I don't think I had appreciation for the fact that it really just pushed the feel of how driving games could play, how the different road surfaces and the physics behind it. And then you watch Panda's documentary and you see, you know, the lengths that they went, you know, to really enhance how it felt over the arcade. So that'd definitely be one that I put in there. Virtual One, I'd probably keep in there, maybe. There's a few others, like a stall maybe. I know that one gets chastised for being unoriginal, but you look at the stuff they did for sprite scaling and just the sheer imagination behind that game. Similar really for Clockwork Knight. There's a lot of that's the thing. Sometimes you think, is the creativity doing something new and fresh and pushing gaming forward? Because you've got to think, you've got influence. You know, how many games have done that after? But then you've got the creativity. And I think in terms of creativity, Sega have always had it. I suppose the discussion is, which console did it best?
I think the fair answer would be that they probably both contributed in their own way. It's like the Saturn definitely represents Sega at its most risk-free time. You know, they just didn't care. Like they were making all this. They had like a blank canvas. They had new technology. They didn't know how to use it. They were learning on the job. They were just throwing ideas at the wall and seeing which ship would stick. And it was just a crazy time. But then with the Dreamcast, yeah, they were creative, but they were more selectively creative, like because they knew that this was the last throw of the dice. It's like this has to work. So it wasn't quite as carefree in terms of creativity. It was like a refinement of the creativity that was on the Saturn, but it was more curated. Like they were just being, because it had to be, you know, they had to try and make sure that what they were picking was not filler. It just had to be all like as close to AAA as they could be. And ultimately, as we know, mate, it wasn't enough, but you know, given the evolvement from the Dreamcast addict to the Sega-holic and what I've learned and the memories that have been unlocked, I'm going to betray my former self and say that the answer to that question is the Sega
It really is Sega more completely off the wall, isn't it? Like you say, they didn't care. I mean, obviously they would have done, but the Dreamcast, it feels unfair to call the Dreamcast safe,
Saturn.
but the Dreamcast, you look at the Dreamcast design from a hardware perspective, you've got your processor, you've got your graphics chip, you've got your RAM, you've got your optical drive. You know, it's very much is your standard piece of hardware from that perspective. You look at the games, you know, it's like, well, we need to make sure we've got our big hitters. So Echo the Dolphin comes back. Sonic the Hedgehog gets the mainline game once again, which you should have had on the Sega Saturn. You get a bunch of, you know, a bunch of resurrected IPs, and then you get then by the same token, you had that kind of that solid foundation. That's why I think it's a bit unfair to call it safe. And you say, well, we'll use that solid foundation as a launch pad to create online, make it online ready out of the box, put a fishing rod controller in there. We'll give you Shenmue, we'll give you Rez, we'll give you Jet Set Radio. And I think to an extent it was we're going to simplify our hardware, we're going to make it easier for developers get to develop games, because that's one of the biggest criticisms from developers on the Sega Saturn. We're going to rely on a lot of our existing IPs. I mean, out of everything, you know, we've talked before about how Sega were Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde every console generation. You know, it's like you like Alex Kidd, we'll get one game on the Mega Drive, and you'll get nothing else that related to the Master System. You like Streets of Rage, Sonic the Hedgehog, and Comic Zone on the Mega Drive? Well, tough shit. Sega Saturn's brand new stuff. Did you like Panzer Dragoon, Clockwork Knight, Bug? Well, no one else did. So because they're not popular, we're not going to refer to them at all on the Sega Dreamcast. So the Sega Dreamcast was like, but we will go back to some of these Mega Drive IPs. I mean, they were meant to be doing a Streets of Rage game. They did do a Toe Jam and Earl game, which eventually got retooled, put onto the Xbox. Pretty sure they had a Shinobi game going on there, which was eventually came to the PS2, turned into the PS2 game. And you know, I'm sure they had Outrun as well in their mind, in the back of their mind then, which obviously became Outrun. So yeah, I think that era of Sega, you saw them lean into their existing franchises a bit more. But I think that did allow them to say, right, well, that's our bedrock. That's where we're expecting to solidify ourselves and play it safe and give ourselves a platform. And now give us Shenmue, Jet Set Radio, Skies of Arcadia, give us all this Rez, Cosmic Smash, give us all this weird and wacky stuff, to you know, show what Sega is all about. Whereas the Saturn is very much, you know, free processors and you know.
Sorry, plaything.
And just, you know, it's like great Panzer Dragoon. You know, who's got an idea for a game? How about a game where you ride a dragon and shoot things? That's a great idea, Futsutsugi. Here's a team of 21 people. Go make it.
That's the Oprah, isn't it? You get a team, you get a team, you get a team. It's like, Virtua Cop, guys that had never done any kind of project before. Have you worked on anything before? No, I'm a rookie. Ah, we're going to port Virtua Cop to the Saturn. Really? And you, Suzuki, will pop in every now and then and make sure you're behaving yourself. Yeah. And that is why I think it was the most creative time, because, like, the Dreamcast, you know, they'd obviously, they'd honed a lot of this. They knew how to work in 3D. And then even the console design itself, it's the most un-Sega Sega hardware. You know, it's very off the shelf. It's very, you know, dare I say, it's very PlayStation-like. You know, small, compact design. Also, they went back to the kind of the lighter colour. People say it harks back to the SG-1000 being white, and it was like an Okawa kind of tribute to go back to the roots of, to say, the SG-1000. I think that's maybe, I don't know, a stretch. I think it was definitely, they were trying to kind of, you know, tap into that kind of PlayStation aesthetic, you know, a smaller console, lighter in colour, big round lid, two round grey buttons either side of the lid, you know. Even the hardware itself, one of the criticisms obviously Saturn had is that it was based on, like, Sega's arcade technology. It was assembled like an arcade board. You know, so it had like the polygon or sprite rendering and pushing capabilities of like a Model 1, but it also took a little bit of the texture mapping from Model 2s, but wasn't as powerful as Model 2. It could do more polygons in Model 1, I believe, but it was like this weird kind of mismatch of both boards, which led to the kind of challenges in doing the conversions. So that was one of the things that Sega corrected. And obviously having Naomi and Dreamcast kind of more or less developed in parallel, you know, so you had a console that was based on an arcade board, or an arcade board based on a console. There's always debate about which one came first. It's like the chicken and the egg, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it made ports for the arcades, especially also the Naomi stuff. It was like they were indistinguishable. You know, you'd really need to look hard to try and find a difference between DOA 2 in the arcade and DOA 2 in the Dreamcast, Power Stone on arcade, Power Stone on Dreamcast. Like, they were nigh on identical, and the ports came out like that. Like, they were a matter of weeks, months before they appeared. So it was, as you say, to call it safe, it's a bit unfair on it, because as you say, some of the kind of creative games that they came up with, like your Resis and your Cosmic Smash, they were very much quintessentially batshit crazy Sega stuff.
And Sega Gaga.
Mate, somebody needs to translate that fucking thing, honestly.
it's works in progress, apparently, but it's
a challenge. Yeah. It's a really hard one. It's, people wanted Princess Crown and Saturn, mate. They've got that. I never wanted that. I just want Sega Gaga. I'm happy for the Princess Crown fans.
Well, I would have Princess Crown. I am loving life right now playing that game.
I liked your video as well, mate.
Thank you very much.
Turnaround time on that was insane. Blanked and it was uploaded. I'm like,
well, I'd already done an awful lot of the legwork beforehand, so before that 1.0 release actually fully landed, and it's just like, yes.
And I've seen the WhatsApp message, it's out! It's like, go!
Well, I was on the GitHub after release Candidate 3 came out. I was hitting the F-right button. Come on, Eve Master, where is it?
Oh, then it was.
The guys at CD Romance as well had a version of it within seconds, it felt like. I modified my own version, but I looked and they'd taken the RC3 version, and then they patched in the EX version from Paul Met as well. I don't know.
So have they got the 1.0 and?
Yeah.
Aye. Bloody hell.
They work fast.
Suppose it saves the people that go link, please, in the comments.
Oh, I just linked back to the GitHub, mate.
That's that. Got to keep it legal, mate. That's
it. Yeah. Well, and let's be brutally honest. The patch notes that Edmaster's put on there are pretty straightforward to go through. You know, people shouldn't have problems patching their own version of the game going through those notes.
People, in, some folk in the comments did. Like I was showing it to GN Martin and the simulant Discord, and he was like, the guy literally couldn't have given you any more help. It's like a step by step guide. Link, please.
Yeah. But I suppose that's just part of the legacy of those games, mate, isn't it? You know, Princess Crown, Sega Gaga, and there's so many more that have been translated over the years. Many more in progress. There was something that broke today. Another translation of the Sega Saturn, and a lot of these are pretty creative games, and I think that creativity from both consoles, I think, just feeds into the community and the creativity behind them. And even when they're just translating, but obviously that, you know, even when they're not creating their own games, and there's some fantastic creations in kind of the homebrew competitions for both consoles and just in homebrew in general. But even something that people might think is straightforward, like porting a game across or translating it, you know, there's an awful lot of creativity that goes into creating the code, into optimizing it, into finding the graphics to use, you know, the fonts to use, the spaces to use. I mean, you look at some of the stuff that Falco Gerges does and posts out, and he's like, oh, I found a new cycle on this SH4 processor. It's just like going into the Matrix, isn't it?
Aye. Well, there's Jane Martin the other night, right, and the Wipeout Discord server, the part of the simulant server where the devs hang out, right? And I'd never noticed this, right? But Jane Martin noticed that when racing in Rapier class on the Terra Nova track, as you exit the tunnel, there was grey polygons on the exit of the tunnel that shouldn't be there, right? And he's playing the PS1 version. He's taking pictures of the PS1 version and putting them on the Discord. He's then turning the ships around to take photographs of the tunnel from the other angle, looking back towards it to see if maybe it was an error and it was like the outside of the tunnel, maybe the polygons had lapped over. Mate, he was doing his own head in, like trying to find these polygons to get rid of them. And it was people checking various versions. I checked the Saturn version, but I couldn't get Rapier class unlocked. I couldn't find a cheat to unlock everything. It was literally like, I've not played the game to complete it, to unlock it. So I thought I'll fire it up and check and see if it's in the Saturn version. And they went, no, it's only on the Rapier side. The next day, mate, he puts a screenshot up and he's found them. He's found these polygons and deleted them. It's like, this is the level of kind of thinking and, like, as you say, creativity these guys have got. Like, they're proper perfectionists. It's like people will watch like videos that we do. Like in my video, there was like a bit of slowdown whenever I get hit by a rocket and there's an explosion. And somebody just replied in a comment and went, slowdown at 4:18. And I'm like, but what else? Like, what else is that all you took for that 6 minutes? Was a bit of slowdown. Is that all you took for that? And that's the thing that when I get my back up, it gets my back up. It's like, because, like, I think with the homebrew stuff, there's just so much entitlement. And I've said it before on here as well. It's like if you watch a video that we do on homebrew stuff, see if you find something that's genuinely a bug or something, like, use the GitHub to report it, to raise it as an issue. And do it in a respectful way. Don't make an arky comment on a YouTube video or else make demands for stuff. What we need now, like somebody replied and went, where's the light trails from the back of the ships? I replied, they're in Wipeout 2097.
Yeah.
They're no in that game. You know, this is not the best Wipeout game. So it's not, it's the best version of this version ever. Not the best Wipeout ever. People saying Wipeout 3 HD or Wipeout HD on the PS3 and VR's better. But this is Wipeout on the Dreamcast. There's no relevance. So it's like, I think the homebrew stuff, like these guys are just, as you said, mate, it's like reading the Matrix, and I've looked at Falco and Skimp and Esperil, and these guys all put up stuff and they say they've found something. It's like, see that the guy for The Hangover with the math shit equations flashing in front of his eyes. That's these guys. They're just like super talented and like complete brainiacs when it comes to this stuff. Like they see things that nobody else notices. Like you think you've seen something that's a bug that they've not seen, and you're raising it on a comment in a channel. Trust me, these guys have seen it and they're working on it. Nothing, like with GN Mark, especially, man, this guy does not. He put up 2.2 for Wipeout, which I knew was coming. Because he put it up in the server, and I mentioned, well, I'm doing a video in 2.1, and he said, no, 2.1 is fine. The changes for this are very kind of minimal in terms of it was like adding like 3D third-party controller support, a very small audio glitch fix. It was nothing that was going to impact the gameplay. And then I'm in a Discord talking about 2.2, and he says, it's fine. I'm already working on 2.3. And I'm like... You know, and he's even mentioned some as far ahead as 3.0. You know, there's things that he wants to add that I'm obviously not going to mention. There's things that he's working on as well that he's looking at, and what he's got planned for this port is just mental. You know, so the homebrew stuff, that's the exciting thing. I think that's the legacy, I think, of Sega's creativity on both consoles, is that they have inspired people who were kids or teenagers at the time to push the boundaries of the machines they grew up with, which is something we've never seen before. You know, it's these are people that these were their favorite machines, and now they're coming to them with new eyes, new skills, and wanting to prove a point that these systems can do what they were told back in the day they couldn't. You know, and that's the exciting thing. Like, where could these machines go? As we spoke about in a previous show, like where could these machines go? What are we going to see in the years ahead?
Yeah, and I think it is really is it's kind of an infectious passion, an infectious level of creativity that just filters through to this generation of, you know, developers, homebrew developers that are creating these games, porting these games, translating these games. And that kind of comes through, and I think that kind of comes through the years, through Sega's work. You know, you think about Jan Martin adding all this crazy stuff to wipe out, you know, that's almost like AM2 adding a bunch of stuff to Fighters Megamix, you know, you know, it's like, let's put this in there. Let's put a Hornet car in there. Let's put all these tracks in it. It's like the Doom 64 port. Let's add this whole episode in there. And it's, yeah, I think that's kind of part of the legacy of these two consoles. It's that passion for the hardware and to see it perform and do these things. It's the creativity to creating solutions to problems. It's like, you know, Falco and the team trying to optimize GTA 3 on the Dreamcast. You know, they're finding all these nooks and crannies to optimize the code. We heard the same thing from Yu Suzuki and AM2 when they're porting Virtua Fighter 2 to the Sega Saturn. You know, they're having to create all these new processes in order to make sure that they could store the animations in the Sega Saturn's memory in before every fight. It's a pattern, isn't it? It's that same infectious creativity and passion that filters through to the modern day. And I think that's still why these two machines are still so special to everyone, because it kind of... For Clockwork Night, you've got Cube Cat, you know, you've got these games that come out you've got these new games coming to the Sega Dreamcast, all these new experiences that these talented people are bringing in, inspired by the work that came onto the two consoles just before.
Aye. I mean, there was an exchange I had with Jay and Martin the other night there, and talking about Wipeout on the Saturn. And after I played it, I says, mate, you've ruined like Saturn Wipeout for me with this port. He replied back savagely, Saturn Wipeout ruined itself. I kind of felt like the Roy Hodgson gif. It's like the head to the side, like, I like the Saturn port of Wipeout. It's like, I think its handling mechanics, despite its lower frame rate, are actually better than the PlayStation version. But
There you go.
I feel Dreamcast version, it's another level, mate. It's just mental.
Yeah. Any more games from either side that we need to pick up on? I mean, we've talked about a lot of Sega games over the years, mate. I'm sure on the spot now, I mean, other Dreamcast games, we've mentioned Cosmic Smash, mentioned Crazy Taxi. Any others on there to fight the Dreamcast corner that you think?
I mean, a kind of left field choice, you could look at F355 Challenge.
Yeah.
You know, the culmination of Yu Suzuki's quest for realism, that obsession with Ferrari that started with Outrun. You know, obviously it runs on the Naomi multi-board because you've got one board powering each of the windows and then the deluxe cab. But the Dreamcast port of that, it's beautiful. There's no racing game like it. I know a lot of racing games, you can turn like assists and all that kind of on and off, but there was nothing that let you turn them on and off on the fly while racing. And like you know yourself, mate, if you turn all the assists off for a laugh and get cocky and think, ah, I'll just blitz off this line, no bother, you ain't going anywhere. That car is just going to die. Like you just need to know how to, like, the right revs to hit and when to release the hit the gas and release the brake and just everything. It's like a proper simulator. And that was a level of simulation that I don't think you'd seen. It was an arcade game, but it kind of brought a level of realism to driving that not even Gran Turismo had. For all your camber heights and exhaust upgrades and mufflers and all these kind of things that you would buy and upgrade in GT, like F355 was just like you were sitting your arse in a Ferrari. Like, and you had to respect the vehicle, you had to know how to handle it, how to start it, you know, how to drive it properly without spinning out. It just added a whole new depth. So I may be a bit of a left field choice, but I still think that realism in itself is not just creativity, but the culmination of Yu Suzuki's entire vision for what he wanted a racing game to be.
Yeah, you can see how that would have influence other games down the line as well, kind of games like, you see it today with games like Assetto Corsa, I think is one that springs to mind, those sort of games. You really do get, and it goes back to what I think is Sega. You had Sega trying to get their surefire hits, and then you had Sega being Sega. F355 was Sega being Sega in a Dreamcast. Sega GT was Sega trying to find something that was marketable and safe, and ultimately that game comes off as a little bit stale, a little bit sterile. I think, you know, you've got your arcade ports. I've mentioned the Sega Bass Fishing. I always call it Get Bass because I've always had the Japanese version.
Aye.
Obviously, that's the
right fish.
Whoa, a big one! Space Channel 5 probably deserves a mention.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more for its concept than anything else, because obviously it's a rhythm action game similar to what we've seen before, most notably probably stuff like Parappa the Rapper and stuff, but the way they execute it, the way it presents it, you know, it's very unique and creative. And then you've got games like, I don't know, like Zombie Revenge, even that's, you know, as much as it's kind of a Marmite game, that one, but you can't. And it's obviously a House of Dead spin-off, but the way that it sets itself up and the way that it plays is quite unique and creative. You could go on forever. I mean, the Dreamcast is absolutely full of the games like that. And I think that's the thing about it. Its library is small, but at the same time, there's not really another library like it.
No, the library it's got for the length of time it was on the market is ridiculous. And that's why it's got the reputation that it has. Because like you struggle to find a bad game on it. Even the stuff that was quirky, like Looney Tunes Racing or something, it's still a quality game.
Or Choo Choo Rocket, which they gave away for free.
Exactly. Choo Choo's a great game.
It's you a know, brilliant game.
The quality, the depth of quality in that library is insane. I mean, even you think about stuff like Virtua Tennis. Yeah. You know what I mean? Again, you go, why, how could a tennis game be innovative? We've had tennis games before or are creative, but you know, you think about the tennis games that had been like these again, you had real life players, real life locations, okay, they were based on, they were different names, but they were clearly Wimbledon and the French Open, yeah. Australian Open, US Open. But you had your different shot types, you had, you know, your lob, your smash, forehand, backhand, everything, you know, the rallies you could get in that, it was the closest you'd ever seen in a game to real life tennis. Like, and I remember as well, like, having that running and like one of my mates thinking it was actually a real tennis match on the telly. My man Graham, you watching tennis for? I'm playing it, mate. I'm playing it. Does Tim Henman really have eyes sunk into his skull at that?
Yeah, but I thought it was actually when I was in the bowling alley when I first saw it in an arcade machine. And I was like, what have they put like tennis on over there? And obviously I was at a distance, but I was like, wow, it's actually a Dreamcast game. I'm going to get to play this in pretty soon.
Well, maybe we played, was it Virtua Tennis? Was it 4 or 5 yeah. or something?
Yeah.
Arcade Club. Aye, Novak Djokovic. I've got to take him, so doing fist pumps at an arcade machine because I'm smashing one down the line. Like, come on. Aye. Brilliant game. Stood the test. A lot of the Dreamcast games have done that. They've all stood the test of time very, very well. Like, I was playing like Soul Calibur 2 on the OG Xbox earlier after finally getting the settings right on my picture and playing it in 720p, and it looked absolutely glorious. And I'm playing it, I'm going, but the Dreamcast version doesn't look too far behind it, you know. And obviously, they're kind of the same generation. Yes, Dreamcast is a 6th-gen machine. It's not a 5.5, as some people say. It's a 6th-gen machine. And also the Xbox coming much later, much more powerful. But Dreamcast version of Soul Calibur 1 still can stand beside Soul Calibur 2 pretty proudly and go, I'm quite happy to stand next to you and have a go. It's a beautiful looking game.
It really is. And I think the Sega Saturn library is a little bit different because, unlike the Dreamcast, I think the Dreamcast, and I've said it before, the Dreamcast is the console where it was the first console to really feel, you look at how far games have moved on from the Dreamcast, and in real terms, it hasn't been that much of a leap. The leap from Saturn to Dreamcast, or PlayStation to PlayStation 2, is massive. Now, I think that's why you see so many remasters and remakes of PlayStation 2 and beyond games. You don't see many remakes of 5th-gen games from the Saturn and PlayStation. I think the Saturn requires a bit more investment, but I think it's one of these things where when you pick away at it, that's the game. When you stick with it and really start to embrace what it is, that's when you see the real creativity, because that's when, you know, Sega and the whole industry, you know, Yu Suzuki had shown everyone the way. This is the way with Virtua Fighter. And everyone else was trying to say, right, well, how do we make that work for ourselves? How do we make it work for this genre of game? How do we use this 3D space to create something new and fresh? And Sega went through all sorts of ways to, you know, Nights into Dreams is something completely different. Burning Rangers is, again, completely out there. Bug was them trying, was, well, obviously, is it Real Time Worlds or Real Time Associates? Yes, trying to figure out how a platform would work in 3D, and it works very differently to any 3D platformer these days, and always works like a 2D platformer. But yeah, the Saturn's full of experiences like that. Any that you can think of, any that come to mind on the Saturn?
In terms of, I think where Saturn's creativity comes from, and again, it's from experience down the years and exploring it as a Japanese library. You know, everybody, you know, knows about Marvel Superheroes versus Street Fighter and X-Men versus Street Fighter and Radiant Silver Gun. They're the kind of go-tos, but stuff like Bulk Slash, you know, you've got Shinrai, Jiu Satsushi, Taramaru, games like that that were completely inaccessible. Like, I'd never heard of that game until I got a Fenrir, but you play it and it's like, it plays great. It's got that whole kind of 2.5D rotating kind of stage vibe, kind of almost like sort of like Shinobi, but with kind of lock-on mechanics using magic from like Panzer Dragoon. It's get wacky bosses, even wackier kind of villains, and it's just batshit crazy. But it's the kind of game that would never have got a release over here, you know. And again, we just mentioned like Bulk Slash, the you know, Danthrax and the team, you know, localizing that, you know, going above and beyond to not just translate it, but to record the lines, you know, Stellar Assault SS as well, stuff like that. These are all amazingly creative games. Even stuff like, was it Tribush Happy? Or the hell they the one with a taxi? You know, just mental little kind of Japanese games. And again, these aren't Sega games, you know, but the Saturn in Japan led to, I think, one of the library, the largest game library of any Sega system in terms of publishing is a Japanese Saturn library. No other Sega system has got a bigger published library than the Japanese Saturn, and there's just so much depth in it. It's like, it's a totally different machine, you know. And I think that gets back to what you think about like Mel, Sega Lord X. Like, his view of the Saturn is completely different to like even our views of the Saturn, because he imported one and he lived, you know, vicariously via imports. So it's the same with us with the Dreamcast. It's like, we don't really like pay attention too much to the kind of the PAL stuff because we imported a machine. So we were drawn to the Japanese kind of library as well. It's a kind of similar thing. So the creativity for the Saturn, it comes from the Japanese library. And thanks to these ODEs, you know, that are now cheaper than ever with the Saru, that's only getting better and better. There's no better time to jump in and discover it.
Yeah, especially with stuff like Saru that you can just plug in, no disassembly required. Stick it in your cartridge slot in there, and away you go. But yeah,
try Rush Depi. That's, I have to look it up there how I pronounced it. Astra Superstars as well. Another brilliant batshit crazy beat 'em up. You know, flying in the air, giant sprites, just absolutely amazing game. Love that.
Even stuff like Virtua Fighter Kids, though. You know, what was the thought process behind that? That's just,
mate, how does Akira's legs manage to reach his opponent? His head's too big. You do a double kick with his wee tiny two legs, but his head's a way out past his body. It's like, doesn't it work? But, and it looks amazing on the Saturn, that high resolution mode. It looks so pin sharp.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's, you know, the gameplay, you wouldn't play over Virtua Fighter 2. It's a novelty. It's, you know, just the balls to actually make it. You know, someone was just playing around with the character models in Virtua Fighter 2, turned them all into kids. It's like, oh, great idea, ship it. And we got that in PAL territories. We didn't get off the other stuff. Lost to know how that sold, but yeah. But I think at the end of the day, mate, both consoles demonstrate Sega at their creative peak. I feel it's a little unfair to the Mega Drive and Master System, because there's some very Sega, very creative stuff on those as well. But I feel like they're not as out there as the other two consoles.
I think it's the change to 3D and the sheer lack of experience. I think that's like 2D gaming. What you were seeing with the Mega Drive and also the Master System before, it was like an evolution of that 2D gaming, but it was still pixel art. I'm not saying it makes it any easier to make games or anything, but they were still dealing in tried and trusted, you know, format of making games and development tools. And then 3D comes along and just mixes everything up, and people are caught in their heels. You know, the only people within Sega who had any kind of experience was really AM2. You know, at that point, they and even at that, how long had they been doing it for? It's like Model 1 board, so at 92, 93, starting out with Virtua Racing and Virtua Fighter. So they were still learning on the job as well. They were learning as they went along. Virtua Fighter changed the course of the industry, so it was an unparalleled time in terms of just innovation and creativity. And I think like Dreamcast, as you say, that kind of it built on the foundations that Saturn laid. You know, there was now templates in place, development tools in place. There was a direction for gaming, and the Dreamcast was able to kind of capitalize on that, whereas Saturn was just like, you want to make a game? It's like, why are you bothering me?
Yeah.
We'll get a go.
Yeah, I think the Mega Drive has a few highlights. You have your Toad Terminal, Comic Zone, obviously Sonic the Hedgehog, which I mentioned on our discussion with Mel, you know, is one of the games that was hugely influential and in its own way, very innovative and creative. But a lot of them were following pre-established trends. You know, as great as Streets of Rage Trilogy is, they are evolutions of the Final Fight formula. You know, a lot of arcade ports to the Mega Drive. Toad Geminal became a 2D side-scroller, so it lost a lot of creativity in that kind of transition. And then you go back onto the Master System, and it's mostly arcade ports. And where it isn't an arcade port, you get something like Axe Battler, The Legend of Golden Axe, which is it's just basically just a Zelda game, and it was then basically chasing Zelda. So I think, and then yeah, there's 3D stuff as well, mate. I think that's that new frontier. It's like the Old West, where everyone was just trying everything that they could to try and get 3D to work. How are we going to make 3D work in or what can we do with this 3D space? And all the answers to that were nothing was solidified. Even look at PlayStation at the time, and you got stuff like, I'm not a fan of it. Some people are, but Jumping Jack Flash, you know, it's like, that's an interesting way to tackle a kind of a mascot platformer game. Don't think it didn't work for me, but some people it did. But yeah, it was everyone Jumping was trying
Jack
to find
Flash. Was that not a Whoopi Goldberg movie as well?
Oh, my heavy. I don't think she was a rocket powered rabbit though.
Remember that? Maybe she, you know, bite a guy in the balls in that at the end.
No, I don't remember.
I think she's getting held captive in an office or something, and getting blackmailed. And that's how she escapes. I remember what it was a cracking comedy film. I liked that.
But mate, I think we'll leave it there. I think after 5 years later, it was Dreamcast versus Saturn. I think for me, it's still Saturn. For you, you've done the old flip flop.
That's it, mate. Done a heel turn.
But as always, we'll open it up to our viewers and listeners. What do you think was Sega's most innovative console? It may not be either of these. You may think that it's the Master System or Mega Drive. I know there's a few fans of both out there that might champion either. And mate, cheers for 5 years of doing this. It's been superb, mate. And here's to the next 5, 10, 50.
Mate, we'll just keep doing this as long as we've got a voice and the time, you know. We laugh because we went on hiatus, you know. I still remember the conversation. You know, we were struggling to find time to record and nail down a slot, and you know, we were away for 9 months, but we missed it. And it's just ironic that we've came back and now we've got a YouTube channel, which is also scary, the fact that come October, that'll be 3 years old.
Yeah.
You know, it's again, where is that going? You know, it's crazy how fast time's going by and the content we're racking up. But it's been amazing, mate. It's the best Twitter DM I could have sent.
Yeah. And of course, we couldn't have done any of that without you guys, our viewers and listeners. And really humbling when we hear those sort of things. It's crazy how far we've come and how far this journey has taken us, and what we've seen and what we've done, and there's still more to come. You know, we're both at this time actively working on a couple more videos. There's still podcasts being recorded, so the journey goes on. And so thank you very much for watching and listening. So if you've enjoyed this episode, then give us a like and a subscribe. Get involved in the discussion via the comments below and via Discord, either through the Sega Guys one or through Radio Sega. And if you want to be extra mega, Think about becoming a member with a bunch of awesome perks from as little as 99p, such as getting your name read out, just as James is about to for our All Access members right now.
Sure am. Our Akira All Access members for today's show are G-Man, Stiff Peaks, Mikowski, Craig Williamson, Sega Saturn, Shiro, Resident SD, P-Wall, Peter 007, Andy Mackey, Nick Tullock, Greg Matthews, Tom Fum, Kaiju Leviathan, Nelson Serino, Anthony Riddle, and David Owens. So thank you very much to all our members and subscribers for your continued support. As Dan says, you know, we have great fun doing this, but we only do it because you guys watch. Without you guys tuning in and getting involved in the comments, whether it's Discord, X, YouTube comments, YouTube posts that we put out, all that kind of stuff, all that engagement, you know, it's extremely humbling that you guys, you know, take enjoyment out of listening to two old guys talk about their past and get all nostalgic, you know, the virtual gaming midlife crisis, as my wife calls it. It's humbling that so many people enjoy what we're doing. As long as you guys are enjoying it, we'll keep making it. So thank you very much.
Yeah, makes me laugh. Oh no, it's Alex keeps saying he's having a midlife crisis. That's why he's buying PlayStation games. Keeps showing he's got a big stack of PlayStation 2 games, and I can see in there like Grandia 2. I'm like, why are you buying that on PlayStation 2, mate? It's a crap port. It's a shit port.
Get him told, man.
Yeah, get a Dreamcast and get the Dreamcast version. Superior.
Saying that, I don't want to be in Alex's radar, man. Supposing that, you know. I think we just shut the channel down if we ended up on Alex's radar, but thankfully we're not like console warriors for like Xbox and PlayStation, so we're safe. You know. Like that, as I'm roasting, you don't want me. It's just
no. I mean, obviously, we're Sega fans, but
we're trying to impart some to give him the better experience of enjoying the game at its optimal version.
But yeah, I know. But yeah, it's our own midlife crisis, mate, and our midlife crisis is all Sega. And thank you all for joining us on this journey. And 12,000 subscribers as well that we just flew past, which is, well, beyond anything that we ever conceived of when we first brought the channel together. So thank you very much. The journey keeps going. And until next time, we'll see you on the Sega side.